So good to be with you tonight and to see the good number of visitors that we have. We have several, as has been mentioned. We're glad that you can be among us tonight to worship our God, praise His name, and to study His Word a while together. And we'll be doing just exactly that and looking at a topic that I think is much needed in the world today and in the Lord's church. And I pray that you'll pay close attention. Take notes if you need to. The PowerPoint slides will be available online afterwards, I think. And this is a study that is indeed a study of something that, in my mind, is very, very important for us to consider. And it is the subject of, if I can turn my clicker on here, the subject of the Christian and alcohol. In Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 18, the Apostle Paul says, "Do not be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit." We need in our culture and in the church a reality check on the issue of drinking alcohol. Drinking, of course, in our culture and our society is made to look enjoyable in advertisements, in TV, and in movies. In our country, over $2 billion a year is spent on advertising alcohol. They're trying to make it just as attractive as they can. Acceptance of drinking alcohol is ingrained in our culture at every turn. We are told it's okay if we drink responsibly, although I've never actually known anybody who I knew to be a drinker who told me that they always drank responsibly. Almost all of them that I've ever talked to about it said, "Oh yeah, there was a time that I slipped up, drank too much, got behind the wheel," whatever it was. But we're told it's okay if we drink responsibly. Our culture focuses its attention nowadays on making sure that homosexuals are not mistreated, but rather that they're celebrated. Our culture focuses on getting the children to eat their vegetables and not allowing adults to drink a supersized drink when they go to McDonald's. While the real life consequences of drinking alcohol are virtually ignored, it seems that the only issue our culture has with drinking at all is if you drink and you drive. Other than that, alcohol is accepted and the drinking of it is ignored. We need a reality check. We need to understand and just look clear-eyed at what is happening in the world around us in the United States of America today. And it's not pretty. Over 10,000 deaths per year in the U.S. are related to drinking and driving. On the average, every 90 seconds, someone is injured in a drunk driving crash. Many of us, including myself, have lost loved ones, friends, and acquaintances because of those who drink and drive. It's estimated that 4 million people are victimized each year by 2.6 million drunk driving crashes. Alcohol is directly connected with violent crime in our country. According to the Bureau of Justice, 37% of state prisoners serving time for violent crimes in 2004 said they were under the influence of alcohol when they committed their crime. Then you have all of the effects on home and personal life. It's related almost invariably to domestic violence. Policemen who go on domestic violence calls will tell you that almost without variation, alcohol will be involved. There are exceptions, but many times alcohol is involved. Think about the breakup of families. Studies have literally shown that the more you drink, the more likely you are to get divorced. There is a direct correlation between how much you drink and whether or not your marriage is going to last. It's a direct correlation. Of course, you have other risky behaviors that people engage in, drugs, sexual behaviors that are immoral, unintended pregnancies as a result of that, loss of job, all of those sorts of things are effects of alcohol. When's the last time you heard a news report on any of that? Happening all the time around us, all the time. Here's what it's doing in our culture. Alcohol has a net negative effect on health. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about what it does to the brain, to the liver, to the pancreas, to the chances of increased chances of contracting cancer, of the mouth, of the esophagus, of the throat, of the liver, of the breast. All of those things are proven scientific facts. What it does to your immune system, just one episode of binge drinking, what it can do to your immune system. Someone says, well, I saw a study or someone said that actually alcohol is good for your heart, or maybe it helps your arteries. Doctors, in fact, admit that when they cut open cadavers, bodies of dead folks, cadavers of those who have been drunks, they do have clean arteries, but they have diseased livers. So maybe alcohol does help a little bit with one part of your health, but it's like, you know, shooting yourself in the foot to try to cure cancer. It's not going to do a lot of good. It really is counterproductive. The net effect on health is overwhelmingly negative. These are real, true life consequences of drinking alcohol. Many of them, and our focus tonight is that many of them have spiritual implications. Many of them do. And it's those that we're concerned about. What does God say about drinking alcohol? Don't let this reality check bounce. Let's look at what God says about drinking alcohol. And I don't really have the time tonight. There are a lot of passages, both in the Old Testament and New Testament. I'm going to be stretched to get you all out of here by the time we're supposed to get out of here, but we don't have time to look at everything that could be looked at. But I want to present some things to you. Again, it's a study for your consideration. There are a couple of words I want to look at, especially in the first part of the lesson. The first one of them is wine. The word wine occurs many times in both the Old and New Testaments, in most translations of our Bible. It's used, of course, of the liquid product of the grape, both fermented and unfermented. There are three general words, two Hebrew words and one Greek word for wine. There are many other words in Hebrew, and I'll talk about one of them in a little while, about 10 words in Hebrew that can refer to drinking wine or sometimes alcoholic drink, and a couple of words in Greek, but we're not make this a big word study. But of the Hebrew words, yayin is a very common word that's translated wine. It can definitely sometimes mean just grape juice. And I know that from Isaiah 16 and verse 10, where the text says that no treaders will tread out wine in the presses. So they're treading out the wine, they're pressing the wine, and the juice that comes out is called, well, it's called wine. But you know, at that moment, it's not fermented, it's not alcoholic. So if you didn't have any other verse on that Hebrew word yayin, there you would learn that it can mean just the juice of the grape. Sometimes in Hebrew it means that. Another word translated wine sometimes is the word tirosh. It's often translated new wine in the Hebrew, or out of the Hebrew. It's used in Isaiah 65 and verse 8, where you found that new wine, or wine, can be found in the cluster of the grape. Again, that would just be the juice. It would not be fermented. It would not have alcohol in it. So here you have a couple of passages where these general words for wine are used, where it's obvious that it's not talking about wine that contained alcohol. There's also a New Testament word, oinos, which is the very common word used in the New Testament for wine. It also is a word which may refer to fermented wine, but sometimes refers also just to grape juice. And you can see that usage of it, for instance, in Mark chapter 2 and verse 22, where Jesus says that no one puts new wine into the old wineskins, else the new wine will burst the wineskins. And there he's talking about the process of fermentation. So you don't take, you know, fresh grape juice with the fermentation process and put it in an old wineskin, because the process of fermentation is going to stretch it. So here, obviously, he's using the word wine to refer to unfermented grape juice, what we might call it. So in these usages, and actually several others that I could show you, the word wine in the Bible sometimes refers to just the juice of the grape. Sometimes it refers to grape juice that has been fermented with a very low alcohol content. The alcohol content in fermented wine depends on how much sugar was in the grape to begin with, largely. So it could be wine that might have 1 or 2% alcohol if it were fermented, all the way up to 9 or 10%. And I'll talk about that some more in a minute. But you say, well, when you read the word wine then in the Bible, what is it? Is it grape juice? Is it 1% alcohol? Is it 10% alcohol? How do you know? Well, the only real way you can know is just by looking at the context in which it's used. And sometimes you can't tell by that. So you can't really jump up and down and say, well, this mentions wine and therefore it's okay to drink alcohol. Or because it may not be talking about wine that had alcohol in it. Those are just thoughts for us put in our minds. Even when fermented, many wines contain low levels of alcohol. And again, the context helps us to decide the meaning of wine in a given passage. The other word, or actually it's usually translated as a phrase, that I'd like to discuss with you, and this is very, very important for our lesson tonight, is the phrase strong drink. And it's found a number of times in the Old Testament. It's translated from a Hebrew word, shikar. And according to Brown, Driver, and Griggs Hebrew lexicon, shikar means strong drink, intoxicating drink, fermented or intoxicating liquor. Strong's dictionary says it's an intoxicant that is intensely alcoholic liquor, strong drink. So this one Hebrew word, shikar, it's usually translated strong drink or intoxicating drink in our English translations, is found a number of times in the Old Testament. It is condemned or limited everywhere in the Old Testament except as an offering or medicinally. And I'll just go over a number of passages real quickly with you to demonstrate that, and we'll also talk about its use briefly as an offering and as medicine. So notice with me, for instance, in Leviticus chapter 10 and verse 9, we learn that the priests were not to drink wine or intoxicating drink, that's shikar, they were not to drink it while on duty. Now, just as an aside here, for those who would like to justify Christians drinking alcohol today, most all of us know that we serve as priests of God. We are a royal priesthood. When is it that we're not on duty as priests? When is that? The priest that was on duty in the Old Testament was not to drink strong drink. Then look at Numbers chapter 6 and verse 3, and I'll just go by these quickly. A Nazarite who was to separate himself from wine and strong drink, the text says. In Judges 13, with the birth and raising of Samson, both Samson's mother and Samson himself were not to drink strong drink or wine or any product of the grape, as far as that goes, I think. In Numbers 28 and verse 7, there's an interesting passage that tells us about a drink offering that's to be offered. It includes strong drink. And they were to take the strong drink in that drink offering and not drink it, but pour it out before the Lord onto the ground. But they were to offer the strong drink as an offering or a sacrifice to God. The only place that it's allowed to be drunk in any sort of a situation that's not medicinally in the Old Testament is found in Deuteronomy chapter 14 and verse 26. Sort of an interesting passage. It's talking about the tithe offering of the Old Testament. And the instruction is that you shall spend that money, your tithe money, for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink, and that's shikar, strong drink, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires, you shall eat therefore before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice you and your household. So basically, if I'm understanding this instruction properly, what an Israelite was allowed to do was to, we would say, indulge himself. He could eat a lot of meat, maybe even more so. He'd just eat whatever he wanted to. And on this occasion, he was allowed to drink some strong drink as he did that before the Lord. So he was indulging himself, but it was something that was done as an offering. Not necessarily allowed for just everyday use, was it? Not something that was just supposed to go on all the time, obviously. That's really the only place in the Old Testament where it might be said that this was a positive use of it, except for over in the book of Proverbs in chapter 31 and verse 6, where we're told to give strong drink to him who is perishing. So somebody who's about to die and who's in pain, you might give this strongly alcoholic drink to, this shikar. And of course today, We use morphine for that sort of thing when somebody is on their deathbed and in a lot of pain. But that was the idea of it, that you would give them alcohol to ease the pain of dying. A number of other passages in the Old Testament, just quickly referencing them. In Deuteronomy 29:6, Israel did not drink strong drink in the wilderness the whole 40 years. In 1 Samuel 1 and verse 15, Hannah was not drunk with strong drink when she prayed before the tabernacle. In Psalm 69 and verse 2, it refers to the song of drunkards who drink this intoxicating drink. In Proverbs 20 and verse 1, wine is a mocker and strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. In Proverbs chapter 31, verses 4, 5, and 6, it is not good for kings or princes to drink strong wine, to drink strong drink, because they would pervert justice. And in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 11, woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, that they may follow shikar. Isaiah 24 verse 29, God will curse the land so that strong drink will become bitter. And notice especially the last two passages, Isaiah 28 and verse 7. Isaiah 28 and verse 7. And here's what it says. They also have erred through wine and through intoxicating drink. They are out of the way. The priest and the prophet have erred through intoxicating drink. They are swallowed up by wine. They are out of the way through intoxicating drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. Shikar is used three times in that passage, and every time we're told that people were sinning because they were drinking it. They were out of the way. They were in error. And in Isaiah 56 in verse 12, the prophet says, the blind watchmen are worthless shepherds. Come, one says, I will bring wine and we will fill ourselves with intoxicating drink. These people are worthless in their service to God because they drink intoxicating drink. So that's strong drink in the Old Testament. I think that that word study is important for some conclusions we're going to draw in just a minute. We can't always tell in the Bible if wine in a given text is referring to alcoholic drink or not, but we can tell always this word shikar is, and that's important for our study. Ancient wine or strong drink, whichever word you're using, contained less than 10% alcohol. That's because in its natural fermenting process, the most alcoholic content that can be produced is about 10%. Now, nowadays, that's not the case. Nowadays, they've figured a couple of ways to increase the alcohol content in wines, for instance. They've discovered that by adding sugar in the fermentation process, they can up the amount of alcohol in wine to about 15%. And then also, once they get it to that level, and it's fermented and the product is finished, they can just add straight alcohol to it and increase the amount of alcohol in it even more. So the point we're going to drive at is when we compare strong drink in the Old Testament to modern drink today, basically most of our modern drink, most of our modern alcoholic drinks are, if you take strong drink from the Old Testament, it's strong drink on steroids. It's strong drink with multiple times more alcohol in it than strong drink had in the Old Testament. And I hope you see the problem there. I hope you see what the issue now is going to be. As I said, ancient strong drink was no more than 10% alcohol. I'd like to quote for you from a fellow by the name of Bruce Waltke. And he said that strong drink denotes any inebriating drink with about 7 to 10% alcoholic content. He makes this comment in the New International Commentary of the Old Testament. But the reason that his comment is so important, you and I are not Hebrew scholars. And even a brother like Bob Waldron, who knew Hebrew, would not, I think, call himself a Hebrew scholar. This man that I'm quoting is one of the most eminent Hebrew scholars in the world today in the 21st century. He not only written this commentary on the book of Proverbs, he's written a book that is an intermediate Hebrew grammar of ancient Hebrew. He has also written a book entitled The Introduction to Biblical Hebrew Syntax. He is one of the most eminent Hebrew scholars in the world. And he says that strong drink can only have 7 to 10% alcohol. That's That's a weighty scholar, if you will, discussing this, not just your local preacher talking about wine fermentation. So I think that's an important quote. Modern wine, as I've said already, has an alcohol content of 8 to 15%. The processes that I described a minute ago that enable winemakers to increase the amount of alcohol in the wine, those really weren't perfected until the 1800s. There was a French chemist by the name of Jean-Antoine Chaptal who perfected this process around 1800, where you could get the alcohol in wine up from a max of 8 or 9 or so percent up to 15% by adding sugar. And so you have that increased amount of alcohol. And then, as I said, they figured out how to add alcohol to that on top so that some wines today, many, almost all of them, have alcohol content between 8 and 15%. That's higher than strong drink in the Old Testament. And then some wines that are fortified have up to 22% alcohol content, such as the Zinfandels that are sold. Popular beers are somewhat less. They have about 4 to 6% range of alcohol content, and that would be, I think, in the Old Testament, what would be considered a weak strong drink. It would still, I think, be in the category of a strong drink. But there are some beers that have quite a bit higher alcohol content than that. Hard liquors have 40 to 50% alcohol content in them, and some bourbons contain nearly 80% alcohol content in them. So when you're talking about drinking a glass of bourbon, you're talking about drinking something that has 10 times more alcohol in it than the strong drink that is condemned in the Old Testament. I think that's worth us thinking about. Virtually every sort of alcoholic beverage sold today would qualify as strong drink in Bible times. See, the thing is, people look at Bible examples of, well, somebody drank some here and they had some wine there and we don't know how much alcohol in it, but it wasn't any more than 9%. And a lot of times, reality is it'd be 1, 2, or 3%, hardly any at all, if it had any at all, because a lot of it was just grape juice. We already established that. And they want to say, well, it's okay to drink today because, no, well, wait a minute. You talk about apples and oranges. You're comparing something that's completely different from what they even had in Bible times. Comparing it to what we had today. I believe that besides all of that, for the Christian, that drinking is just prohibited in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3. I'd like you to turn to that passage, and this is one I talk a lot about when I'm talking about the use and misuse of alcohol. In 1 Peter 4, Peter says, therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same mind, for he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live for the rest of his time in the lust of the flesh of men, but for the will of God. We have spent enough of our past lifetime doing the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. There are three words here that are related to drinking alcohol. The first of them is drunkenness. I think we know what that means. A person is falling down drunk. They are violent, or they can't walk straight, or they are obviously greatly impaired. Maybe they can't even talk straight. Revelries is basically what we think of when we think of a drinking party today, more like a frat party, the wild sort of parties that are sometimes even used on television today to advertise beers. You see people drinking certain beers or alcohol at these, you know, wild parties, and then they're supposed to be having a good time. So that's what a reveling is. But the third word is important. I think each one of these words expresses a different misuse of alcohol. One, drunkenness. Another, the drinking party, the revelings, the wild time. And then the word that's translated drinking parties in the New King James Version, it is translated from the Greek word potos, and it's also translated banqueting in the King James Version, or carousing in several other versions. It literally meant a drinking without reference to the amount that's being drunk. And I get that definition from another eminent scholar by the name of R.C. Trench, whose little book, Synonyms of the New Testament, is a standard work for defining and understanding Greek words in depth. And R.C. Trench said that this word refers to a drinking without the reference to the amount of drinking. And further, he says that it is a word that doesn't necessarily refer to excess drinking, but it gives opportunity, to quote him, opportunity for excess. Okay, so you go maybe to a party at the office, and it's not that everybody's falling down drunk, it's not that it's a wild party, but the alcohol is there, and you can have as much as you want, or maybe it's just you go to the river with a bunch of friends, and you have a keg of beer there, it's not that everybody's falling down drunk, but it's that there's the opportunity for excess, and so you drink one, and maybe you didn't drink 10, but the opportunity was there. And if the opportunity was there in that experience, then it is drinking parties. Then it is potos. See, you don't have to get drunk. It's just partaking in a, being in a place where the opportunity for excess is there. In this text, I think it's interesting to note that, the word potos, is a noun in Greek. The verb form of it is patizo. And it's used in passages like Mark chapter 10 and verse 42, where the King James Version talks about giving someone a drink of cold water. How much did they give them? Doesn't say, does it? Doesn't matter, does it? It's just providing somebody with water. That's really what that word is. Not necessarily excessive. Peter's urging us in this text not to go back to a worldly lifestyle. I understand the world accepts drinking. You can drink, go out to a restaurant and drink, not be considered anything about, you know, nobody considers that wrong. You can have a beer in your house, nobody considers that wrong. You can drink at a party at the office, nobody considers that wrong. That's the way the world is with it. Peter says in this text, don't go back to that lifestyle. The Gentiles approve of that. That's where you came out of. Don't go back to that. And he says drunkenness, yes, and he says reveling, but he includes drinking parties in what he's trying to get us to stay out of. Of course, we recognize that drinking alcohol leads to a lot of other sins. Obviously, it leads to drunkenness and intoxication, which is, as we've already seen in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15, 16, 17, and 18, is something the Christian is not to engage in. Drunkenness is a work of the flesh. But we realize that drunkenness is a process, isn't it? How many drinks does it take to get drunk? Say it takes 3 or 4 or 10. After you've taken your first one, you've taken that step to being drunk, haven't you? You say, well, I'm a righteous person, I'm self-controlled, and I can handle just that one drink. Well, suppose that 1 Peter 4:3 wasn't there, and it's not condemned. So you can go ahead and engage in that one drink once in a while. You're a righteous person, and you can, are you more righteous than Noah? Noah was a righteous man. God saved the world because of Noah, didn't he? And you know what happened with Noah? He got drunk. He didn't practice self-control. The Bible says that Lot was a righteous man. The Bible says Lot was a righteous man. You know what happened with Lot? He got drunk, committed incest with his daughters as a result. So the person that says, well, I'm righteous and I'm strong and I'm self-controlled and I can handle that first drink and I'm not going to let that lead me down the road to wherever. Maybe you're better than Lot. Maybe you're better than Noah. Even righteous people can be ensnared. The real problem, as I see it, is a lack of self-control that alcohol brings. Of course, the Bible teaches us to be self-controlled. A number of passages add to knowledge, self-control, 2 Peter 1 and verse 6, Titus 1 and verse 8, a bishop must be self-controlled. Definitions of these words include mastering your desires or your passions, having power over yourself, controlling, curbing yourself, restraining yourself. So all of us have this responsibility to be self-controlled. How much alcohol does it take for it to loosen your inhibitions? When you just begin to lose self-control, how much does it take, do you think? You don't have to be drunk, do you, for your inhibitions to start to be loosened and you lose a little bit of self-control? How much alcohol do you think it takes? Well, we know that certain driving skills, such as steering a car, are impaired with as little as 0.02% of alcohol in your blood. Now, I realize that drunk driving, driving under the influence, it has to be 0.08. But, of course, scientists have studied this in great detail and found that impairment actually begins at 0.02. A 160-pound man who drinks two beers on an empty stomach is at 0.04 an hour after he drinks them. Does he still have self-control? Are his inhibitions still what they ought to be? Let me ask you this. When does impairment in, if that's when impairment in driving skills occurs, when does impairment in spiritual skills occur? How many drinks does it take for you not to be able to pray with the sharpness that you should, with the conviction that you should, with the faith that, how many drinks does it take for you to not be able to make parenting decisions as you should? And on we could go. How much self-control are you willing to give up when it comes to living a life for God? Much more could be said about this, and for sake of time, I'll move on a little bit. I want to spend just a few more minutes, though, talking about some things that I've heard. This isn't everything, but just quickly I'll go down a list of things that people say, people who are Christians, say to try to defend drinking alcohol for anything but medicinal purposes. Somebody says, well, Jesus made wine. He did make wine. He made a lot of it. It was good. In fact, if you read the text, you'll find in John chapter 2, he made about roughly 150 gallons of wine. He made a lot because they ran out of wine at that feast. Now, the text doesn't say whether there was alcohol in the wine or not, so nobody can say 100% just from that word, oinos, whether there was wine in that, whether there's alcohol in that wine or not. But I want you to notice a couple of things from the text. When you look over at John chapter 2, and you see down about in verse 11, the master of the feast said to the bridegroom, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, the inferior. But you have kept the good wine until now. The master of the feast parallels what usually happens at a wedding feast to what happened here. And he says, basically, what usually happens is, you know, you put out the good stuff and then everybody drinks a lot and they're satiated and their palates are, you know, completely filled over with the wine. And then you put out the bad stuff and they can't really discern that. They can't really taste it. But you have kept the good until the end. And the implication of all of that is that everything is parallel between what usually happens and what's happened here, except that the good stuff is put out at the end. Now, I'll say this. In Jewish culture, many Jews considered the grape juice to be the good stuff, by the way. There are references to that in ancient literature. So that still doesn't say whether it had alcohol in it. But my point is this. Whatever it was that these folks were drinking at this feast, according to the master of the feast, they had well drunk. I don't know, was it a one-day wedding feast? Was it a seven-day wedding feast? I've had people say, well, it was stretched out over a period of time. They weren't all falling down drunk. Doesn't matter. The text says they had well drunk. Whatever it was, they'd been completely satiated by whatever it was they were drinking. And then Jesus gives them 150 more gallons of it. You think it had alcohol in it? You going to charge the Son of God with that? I think not. Timothy was told to take wine. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 23, where that's often used as an excuse, a justification. Timothy was told, 1 Timothy 5:23, use a little wine for your stomach's sake and for your frequent infirmities. Up until this point, you might notice that Timothy had been a teetotaler, or I guess a water totaler. He had not been drinking any wine. Paul tells him to drink, notice, a little wine, not a lot. And what was the purpose of it? For his stomach's sake, medicinally. We don't have a problem with using alcohol as medicine. It's used in some of our medicines today. That's not a problem. And Paul is just saying you can use a little of it for that. Others say, well, you know, only an excess is prohibited. You look at Titus chapter 2 and verse 3, older women were to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine. The ESV says, not slaves to much wine. Titus 1 and verse 7, a bishop must not be given to wine. So these passages are condemning an excess of wine. You can't have a lot of wine, but that means it's okay to have a little, right? It says you can't have a lot, so that means that a little bit is justified. Let's see if that works. See if that logic works somewhere else. Look at James chapter 1 and verse 21. James 1 and verse 21. Therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. So we're to lay aside an overflow of wickedness. So that's an excess. We don't want a whole lot of wickedness. But just a little bit of wickedness is okay, right? By that reasoning. Because the overflow, the excess is condemned, then if people reason, well, then a little bit's all right. No, that's not how it works. That's not how it works in quite a number of passages, actually. Just because a lot is condemned does not mean that a little bit is okay. It may be. It may not be. But condemning a lot doesn't excuse a little. You have to go to other passages to talk about what about a little. And right there in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 4, where we were a minute ago, you remember 1 Peter 4 and verse 3 condemns the drinking. 1 Peter 4 and verse 4, the next verse says, in regard to these sins he's talking about, such as drinking, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood, one translation says excess of dissipation, a flood of dissipation, an excess of dissipation. So a little bit of dissipation is okay. Just don't go to the flood. Just don't go to the excess. I don't think that makes sense. I don't think that's logical. Romans 14, 21. People say, well, you read that verse and it looks like it's okay to drink wine as long as it doesn't cause your brother to stumble. A lot of assumptions there. Was the wine fermented? Did it have alcohol in it? This chapter deals with liberties. And I think wine is being included with the meats that are being talked about, possibly sacrificed to idols and in pagan rituals of gluttony. We don't know the reason. But what I do know is what the passage says. It doesn't say it's good to drink wine. It says it's good not to, if it causes your brother to stumble. And then someone says, well, wine is a food that it's created by God for man to enjoy. Is it? Did God make wine? Did God make alcoholic beverages? Somebody says, well, when you're making a law, you know, against something that God created for our benefit. Well, number one, God doesn't make wine with alcohol in it. Man has to fiddle with the grape juice to make it into something alcoholic. So that didn't come from God in nature. We have to do that. And secondly, God makes a lot of things that He intends for us to use, some of them to eat or drink, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we can do that without limitation. Now, I've said tonight, there are reasons to take wine with alcohol in it or alcoholic beverages, such as medicinal. So to say, well, yeah, God gave this to us and we can make it so that it has alcohol in it and you can use that for a medicine. That's not forbidding it altogether, is it? So I think that reasoning again is God limits us in a lot of things. God has made a lot of foods that it wouldn't be good to eat or use or drink without limitations. Thank you so much for your kind attention tonight. As we close, I want to just leave you with this about the Christian and alcohol. Jesus said in Luke 17, verses 1 and 2, it's impossible that no offenses should come. Woe to him through whom they come. It would be for him better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea than that he should offend one of these little ones. I know that it would be wrong for me to stand up here and bind what the Lord has not bound. And I have not intended to do that tonight. I pray that I have not. But it would also be wrong for me to put an occasion of stumbling or temptation in any brother's way, to allow someone to think that something was okay when it is not. The story I'm about to tell, I've known to have happened to a number of people. The particular individual that I'm thinking of is somebody whom I'm intimately acquainted with. He was raised in a home of strong Christians. He was taught that drinking was wrong from his youth. He believed that and understood it. He never saw his parents drink. He never saw their friends drink. But not long after leaving home as a young adult, he was told by a preacher that it's okay to drink once in a while. By a preacher. He began buying beer to drink at home. Then occasionally he'd go out with his buddies after work and drink socially. Eventually he would say that he would get buzzed, quote unquote, but not drunk, even though I think the legal definitions are the same. Eventually, as a result of his drinking and impairment in his judgment, he would become involved in gambling, sexual immorality, engaging in the very worst kinds of marital unfaithfulness, losing his faith in the Bible as God's word. Fear for the preacher. I told that young man that it's okay to drink. Because that young man is my son. Stop. It's not okay. Appreciate your kind attention. Tonight, if there's one who's in need of the gospel invitation, it's open. We invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.